Hello and welcome to another brewing podcast. You join us at a rare break in the action at our 6-monthly investment training conference taking place on this occasion in Edinburgh, which gives us a tremendous opportunity to speak to the leader of the Scottish Conservatives and frequently touted candidate to be a future UK Prime Minister, Ruth Davidson. At a time when parties seem to be split down the middle by the central issue of Brexit, we're going to find out, amongst other things, what kind of Conservative Ruth Davidson is.
Maybe that's where I differ from some people within centre-right parties.
So to find out in what ways Ruth is different from other politicians, stay tuned and listen to the podcast after the following brief messages.
The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin.
Hello everybody and welcome to another Brewin podcast. As usual, we have an amazing guest for you today, and on this occasion it is none other than Ruth Davidson, leader of the Scottish Conservatives, who was able to achieve fantastic results, increasing the number of Scottish seats at the last election from 1 to 13. So congratulations on that, Ruth, and particularly congratulations on your latest announcement as well.
Well, thank you very much, Guy, yeah.
So, obviously, I'm alluding to the announcement of your pregnancy. So perhaps I know that you've been very clear about what this means for in terms of the work that you're going to be doing, but if you could just briefly reiterate that for our listeners, how you plan on allowing this to affect your work.
Sure, so I'm just over 3 months pregnant. I'm due in the late autumn, and the plan is to do what thousands of women right across the country do every year, which is work up until I go off maternity leave, go on maternity leave, have a baby, take a few months off and come straight back. And, you know, hopefully the party's still standing around me when I come back. So I've got a very, very good deputy. He's been my deputy for the entire time I've been in office, which is coming up for 7 years now. So he's definitely had the apprenticeship training.
Right.
So he's good to go, and we'll have a bit of a handover, and then I'll be back taking the reins again.
Okay, and I talked about that that strong performance by the Scottish Conservatives in the elections last year. Perhaps you could tell us what it was that really made the difference, that saw that big jump in the number of seats that you won.
Well, actually, I mean, I do feel a little bit of a fraud in that I've had, you know, lots of people saying really well done for your election result in June of last year. But to be honest, the groundwork that went in for that result started a number of years ago. So it's taken me years to become an overnight success, if you like. So when I came in 2011, the party had a really tough couple of decades. We'd underperformed in Scotland. We'd never had more than one MP return for Scotland in all of that time. And I made some huge changes to the party, changes to the personnel, to the way in which we or motivated our policy work, the way in which we ran the party, the way in which we communicated with our voters. So it was a really, really long process. And we kind of hit some steps on the way. So the first big real hit was in 2016, when we overtook Labour, pushed them into third place in Scotland for the first time in over 60 years to become the official opposition in the Scottish Parliament. We had a very, very good local government election in 2017 in the May. About halfway through that campaign, Theresa May said that we were going to have a snap general election, and I made the decision, quite a strong decision, that I wouldn't change a single thing. I wouldn't divert a single piece of resource or personnel into the general election campaign until we got over the hump of the local government elections. And local government elections in Scotland aren't like England. It's not like you have a third of seats up at a time or only some councils are up. It's every single seat in every single council in Scotland. So it's a big national election. And what it allowed us to do is we had a really good local government result. We put on sort of seats in places we'd never had them before. So in Highlands and Islands, we're over 100 years old as a party. We'd never had a seat there. We got 10 in one night. Places like Glasgow, we went from 1 to 8 in the city centre of Glasgow. So, you know, really good results. And it allowed us a few weeks later at the general election to go to people and say, look, it's either us or the SNP. And one of the things we'd always struggled with in Scotland is we were always the third or fourth party. We were never one of the big two. And that really allowed us to say, look, Nicola Sturgeon has said she wants another independence referendum. You don't want that. We want to talk about education. We want to talk about the economy. We want to talk about schools. And she just wants to drag us back to the constitution. There's only two choices. It's us or them. Who are you going to pick? And so all of these events together allowed us to take a really strong offer to the people of Scotland. And, you know, between the 2015 general election and the 2017 general election, so 2 years and 1 month, we put on 500,000 votes. 500,000 more people voted for us than they did just 2 years before. And that allowed us to kind of get over the hump, get over the threshold in all of these seats. And as well as the 13 that we took, you know, there's another 6, 7, 8 where we're within striking distance now. We're within 1,000 or 2,000 votes. So the 2022 general election is going to be very, very interesting in Scotland.
So you think you can keep the momentum going then?
Oh, absolutely. This isn't a black swan moment for us. What I'm working towards and what the team is working towards is making sure that these platforms that we've built for ourselves, first in the Scottish Parliament, then in local government, now in Westminster, these are stepping stones to greater success. We know that we've done all the polling, we've done all the focus grouping, we know that we've still got a bit of headroom where we can grow, and what we have to do is make sure we deliver on that. Now, there's plenty of politics that's going to happen in between, both in Scotland and across the UK. Brexit, in particular, leaving the European Union is going to have a huge impact on what happens. But we've got the party in a good shape to be able to fight the next set of elections. And who knows? I'm ambitious for this party, and I've got a really good team behind me that I've helped to build, and I'm proud of them. So watch this space.
Well, I want to ask you about Brexit, obviously, because your success last year was against the background of the Conservatives being painted really as the party of Brexit. So was that a help or a hindrance to you in a region, obviously, that is not unanimously pro-Brexit?
Well, people know that I fought very strongly for Remain. I have a bit of a history when it comes to referenda of wanting to stay part of wider unions, both Scotland within the United Kingdom and the United Kingdom within the EU. But I'm also a Democrat, and I have to recognise that 17 million people across the UK, including 1 million in Scotland, voted to leave. Now, in my own patch, I represent the seat of Edinburgh Central, where we're sitting at the moment. You know, it was sort of 70% Remain. Across Scotland, it was more than 60% Remain. So, you know, there's a whole lot of work to do in terms of being able to explain what the UK government policy is to leave, because lots of people in Scotland didn't want to leave. I think the big question mark, though, is also kind of what the government in Scotland have done off the back of this. So Nicola Sturgeon, the morning after the vote, so the referendum vote was on a Thursday, by sort of 11 o'clock on Friday morning, she'd stood up in the official residence for a First Minister in Bute House and said that she had already instructed civil servants here in Scotland to drop the necessary legislation for a second independence referendum. And there was lots of people that said, whoa, 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 you know, I didn't vote Remain so that if people voted leave, we were going to get independence. That was not what my vote meant. The vote in this referendum, in the Brexit referendum, was what was the UK going to do? Was the UK going to stay in the EU, or was it going to leave? So people like myself, people like, you know, my parents voted to remain, but not so that Nicola Sturgeon could hijack the vote for something else. And that really muddied the water in Scotland. So there's quite a lot of kind of people from different political parties who have found their voting intentions slightly skewed when they voted on a single constitutional issue. In fact, what's really interesting is all of the analysis of the vote in Scotland, of the referendum vote in Scotland, show that the biggest single voting group for Brexit were SNP supporters. 300,000 people that regularly vote SNP voted to leave, despite the fact being the party was very, very pro-European. So, you know, it's a much more mixed picture than just black and white. But I have to say, someone that's fought two constitutional referenda now, one on independence and one on the EU. I've won one, lost one, is my record on that, which in Scottish footballing terms is not bad. I'll stick with that. But I would happily never fight a constitutional referendum again in my lifetime. I would happily never fight any binary referendum in my lifetime, because I think it pushes people into camps. And I think the bitterness that you've seen both in Scotland after the independence vote, and we're beginning to see now in the rest of the UK after the Brexit vote, the aftermath of a referendum seems to be much more angry and scratchy than the debate that leads up to it. And I think that the divisions are really unhealthy in politics right now.
And Is the constitutional issue in Scotland, do you feel that that's settled now, or could it ever be settled? Is it closer?
Well, I would very much like it to be. We had a vote. 85% of people came out and voted, which was the highest percentage of for any democratic event ever in the history of the United Kingdom. And they were pretty clear about the result. So before the vote happened, we were told that it would be once in a generation. At some points, we were told it would be once in a lifetime. But that didn't seem to last terribly long. The First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has already indicated that she wants to go back to the country and try again. But we'll see about that, because I might have a say in that too.
And then coming to Brexit, you know, how long, because I think what you describe in terms of the splits within parties, it's obviously not just an SNP thing or Conservative thing. It's a Labour thing. It's really kind of split a two or three party system, sort of straight down the middle. When are we going to be able to move beyond this and start talking about non-Brexit issues again and see parties reunified?
Well, I think you're seeing the government, UK government, is trying to do that in some of its policy work. So you're seeing some of the big challenges of our age, the long-term challenges, attempting to be addressed. You know, Michael Gove's doing some good work at DEFRA in terms of climate change and the challenges that we've got there. Sajid Javid, who's now just moved to the Home Office, but when he was in communities, he was looking at long-term house building. So some really, really big issues there. But you know, I hold my hands up, it's being drowned out by all of the twists and turns of the negotiations regarding the UK's leaving the EU and what is that deal going to look like. And I think that the echoes of that are going to go on for some time. Our experience in Scotland is that big constitutional change isn't an event, it is a process. You know, devolution is still going on, but it was voted on in 1997 and it happened in 1999. Well, you know, we're still talking about it. So I think the quite depressing part of all of this is that Brexit is going to last a lot longer past the day in which we leave. But I do think that the worry that I have and what I was trying to say before and to come back to is what we need to get past is the idea that you only listen to someone on a different issue. So you only listen to them on an issue like health or education or house building or taxation if you're already on the same side of them of this other big issue, which is, the referendum on in the rest of the UK on Brexit and here in Scotland on independence. Because that, I think, is called balkanisation. You know, I think that's really unhealthy for the body politic, because we should be able to discuss ideas without dismissing where they come from. You know, we've got to be able to talk about the ideas and the policies themselves.
Well, that's, that presumably is much easier in the UK, where you have got at least one issue that draws support from all sorts of different parties, compared to what we see in the United States at the moment, where it seems like all issues have to fall down party lines, because you're having a much greater sense of partisanship, apparently, than ever before.
Well, actually, I don't think it's confined to either the UK or the US. I think if you look around the world, you've seen the rise of kind of populists and popular nationalists or populist nationalists in lots of different countries. You know, you saw for the first time ever, Marine Le Pen and the Front National getting into the runoffs for the French presidential elections. You've seen the rise of Five Star in Italy. You've seen the rise of, you know, you've now got a coalition in Austria that includes the far right. You see the rise of AfD in Germany. I think you've seen a huge swing in terms of the way in which people consume politics, the way in which they vote for people that what resonates with them, and at the moment, you know, a lot of that is fueled on social media, and we've got questions that are happening right now in terms of data aggregation and all the rest of it. But quite often it's just about social media communication rather than the data aggregation. People are wanting to hear something that they already agree with, so they go into echo chambers and silos, and they also want something that they agree with that's a sentence. They don't really want to listen to the rest of the paragraph. And actually, quite a lot of policy work is pretty complex, and it takes a paragraph, a chapter, a white paper to explain it.
I wanted to ask you, coming back to, again, your success last year,
Did you feel that the manifesto was a big part of your success? Because obviously the broader Conservative manifesto was considered a little bit of a flop.
Well, I mean, I do think we made some choices that helped us swim against the national narrative. So for things that were maybe sort of cultural signifiers of what people thought the Conservatives were, things like the idea there'd be another vote on fox hunting, we were able to say, look, you know, we've got a system that I think works well in Scotland. We're just going to leave it at that. We're not revisiting this. We're not interested in this. We think there are more pressing things, you know, with the country. I don't think anybody's ever won elections telling older voters that they're going to take things away from them. So we chose very strongly, also because we believe that it's right, not to do things like say that the winter fuel payment would change. You know, people, particularly in Scotland, particularly in rural areas, we've got a lot of housing that isn't as energy efficient as we would like to be. A big part of the Scottish Manifesto was actually talking about raising the energy efficiency of housing to make sure that we have people in warm homes. But until we can do all of that, we're absolutely keeping the winter fuel payment where it was. Similarly, we have a different system here in terms of social care. So devolution allows us to use envelopes of resource in different ways. And that's why we have different manifestos north and south of the border and always have had. But we made some pretty clear choices about what we wanted to go to the country with that were different from our colleagues down south.
I'm sorry to jump around a bit, but these answers are so interesting. I've got to come back.
I also talk really fast and at great length, so I apologise to your listeners that are trying to keep up.
That means they get good value for their minutes of listening. So coming back to Brexit then, what kind of Brexit does the government have a mandate to deliver?
I think the issue, again, with referenda is they're very, very short questions on very, very complex issues. Yeah. And the text of the question that was asked of the country is, do you want the United Kingdom to remain within the European Union or do you want it to leave? Now, the rest of it wasn't written, and that's an issue. So lots of different people have lots of different visions for what Brexit looks like. And that's part of the difficulty in navigating all of this, because 17 million people voted the same way, but they didn't necessarily all vote for the same thing, or at least different flavours of the same thing. I guess the practical answer is that the sort of Brexit that you're going to see is the sort of Brexit that can be negotiated with 27 other people across the table.
Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you as a star of the Conservative movement at the moment is
at the moment. It sounds like I'm on trial. At any moment I could make a mess of things, which is also true, yes.
Well, unfortunately, I'm afraid that's the way politics works.
That is the way politics works. So one minute you're up, the next minute you're on your uppers.
I would love to tell you you now have permanence, but no. I'm afraid that's not the case. But I wanted to ask you what heroes of conservatism you might have, because I know it's a question that's been asked of Theresa May and David Cameron in the past. I'd be interested in your answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think, to be honest, most of my heroes don't come from politics. In fact, most of my heroes don't come from real life. They come from books. So I guess growing up, the people that I most wanted to be like or that I thought taught me the most or that I was most in awe of were people like, Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird or the Henry V that you see in Shakespeare's version of the play, which I know is very different from the Henry V that actually lived. I think characters from books, Sir Thomas More in A Man for All Seasons from the play, they were the sort of people I looked up to growing up, which I'm sorry isn't a very sexy answer, I'm afraid, but I did do a degree in English and Scottish Literature, so it is an interest of mine.
Does that make you more of a pragmatic than an ideological conservative, or is that me trying to sort of force a narrative out of that?
Well, I think what all of these people have in common is that they had a very strong sense of something that you couldn't cross, and there was, you know, they wouldn't bend their will in certain areas of their life. So in the case of Atticus Finch, you know, he took on a case that he knew he was going to lose because it was the right thing to do, and the person deserved to have a fair trial. In the case of Henry V, you know, he believed that he was ordained by God to be the king of both countries, and he also had a very strong idea of how you fight a war and how you don't, and that he would punish people of his own side if they were caught thieving or if they were caught all of these other things. Or in Thomas More, you know, he went to jail and then was executed because he had his religious beliefs and didn't believe that Henry VIII was able to just declare a wife that he got divorced from, not, you know, and all the rest of it, and all of these Reformation issues. So I think, I guess, all of them in some sense were prisoners of their own conscience, but only one of them was actually a prisoner. But I'm not sure that any of them held the same political views in terms of macroeconomic policy or prisons policy or anything like that.
Yes, and they were obviously all divided on Brexit as well.
Yes.
Beyond Brexit, then, if you could remind us, what is it that makes you part of the same party as Michael Gove, Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg?
Because I believe in people. Because I think that people make the best decisions about their own lives and the lives of their family. Because I think that grown-ups should be trusted to act as grown-ups. Because I think that a pound in the pocket is better spent by the person that earns it than it's spent by the state. Because I believe in personal choice, personal freedom. I believe in personal responsibility. I mean, maybe you don't talk about the responsibility part enough. So these are the conservative values that I hold. And then you put your values onto the policy area. So, you know, I believe that hard work should get its just reward. I believe people, you know, in terms of immigration, who pick up, you know, their belongings and their families and they move halfway across the world to make a better life for themselves and put in the effort, should be looked after when they get to the other side, you know, and should be valued. I think that in terms of crime and punishment, if you break the social contract, then you don't get to have the benefits of that social contract. I probably have quite a hardline policy on law and order in comparison with some of my conservative colleagues. But I also believe that not everybody starts from the same place on the starting grid. And maybe that's where I differ from some people within centre-right parties, both in this country and in other countries. You know, I didn't come from, you know, money. My parents both came from housing schemes in Glasgow and left school in their, you know, in their teens, at 15 and 16. I went into jobs. And this idea that you just pull yourself up by the bootstraps, well, that's great, but not everybody starts in a position where they've got bootstraps to pull themselves up with. And sometimes that's where the state has to step in. And we've got to realise that it isn't an equal playing field from the start. And that's why you have to look after people who the system has failed, often through no fault of their own.
So is that a description of one nation conservatism? Is that something that you relate to?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think there's a really strong thread of that right through the party that goes from Disraeli to Cameron and beyond. And I would, you know, I think everyone has their own views on lots of different things, but I think that's the sort of wing of the party that I'm most comfortable in.
Okay, well, we are running out of time, but as I've got to ask you, there are some elections going on Thursday, where I come from in London. How do you think they're going to go for Conservatives?
Well, I've been out a couple of times helping out Justine Greening, who's my mate down in Wandsworth. So she's in the Putney constituency, but it takes in a lot of the Wandsworth local authority area. So, do you know what? I think one of the things the party got wrong in the general election last year was the expectation management, that we were going to win it at a skoosh with a majority of 100. And it didn't pan out that way. In a weird way, the pendulum swung the other way and everyone is writing off the party in London. And also, let's not forget, there's lots of other local authorities around the country that are also up or partially up at the same time. And I think we might surprise people because it's been factored in that it's going to be a terrible night for us. And some of the returns that I've seen and some of the conversations that I've had about the pledges that we've got across different local authorities, I think the vote might hold.
And do you feel that Conservatives in London can take as an example what you've achieved with the Conservatives in Scotland, and can they take any of the lessons from that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think London's tough in that if you're the party that doesn't have the mayoralty, then you don't have that figurehead for London. So it's much, much easier for Labour when there's a Labour mayor or for the Conservatives when there's a Conservative mayor to be able to have that single spokesperson, to have that tentpole that you can hang a whole campaign behind. And because the mayoral elections aren't due for some time, you know, we don't even have a candidate in place. And if it had been reversed, if there was a Conservative right now, Labour wouldn't either. And that makes it a really, really tough election for the fact that it's all 32 boroughs of London that are up. You know, so it's like a big, almost quasi-national election, but for London. So I do think that makes it tough. But, you know, nothing in politics stays the same. The pendulum always swings. So if we can get back off the canvas, then there is no part of the country that can't.
Okay, and then just finally, before we wrap up then, could you just remind us on whether you have any ambitions in politics beyond Scottish politics?
Well, look, I've always said that my ambition beyond the job that I have, which is leader of the opposition here in Scotland, is to become the First Minister of Scotland. Like I say, I represent central Edinburgh. I think I'm unique in that I'm the only person that I can think of in recent politics that is the constituency representative for their opponent. So Bute House is in my patch, so I am Nicola Sturgeon's MSP. But I would quite like to swap roles in that I would quite like, rather than just be the MSP for Bute House, I'd quite like to be the MSP in Bute House. So once I come back from having my first child, let's see where that takes us.
Okay. All right. Ruth Davidson, thank you very much.
Thanks, Guy.
Joining us on this podcast. And thanks to all our listeners. As always, we'd love to hear any feedback. So please leave a review on any website where you found the podcast, or on iTunes or on SoundCloud. Or please contact us on Twitter using the hashtag BrewinPodcast.